we should be proud of where we've come from. We're still Australian. You know, when we play for our national team, we play for those colours. We love our country. It's the best country in the world. But we don't forget where our backgrounds come from. And that's what makes us different.
How do we switch, or do we switch, to a national operating model?
You know, dancing around this issue, no one's really standing up and taking responsibility.
That has to become an integral conversation when we move forward for the state of the game in this country.
I think we need to go back to basics and really harness what's made us good, what's made us strong, and how we can engage the public in a more community focus.
Hello and welcome to the PFA podcast. This podcast is designed to provide insights into the organisation's critical work, supporting Australia's professional football players and helping to build the game of football in this country. In this episode, we look at how the game can pave a pathway forward following the devastating impact of the coronavirus, including some big ideas that can galvanise the sport and drive success. Through the lens of a popular concept made famous by American researcher and author Jim Collins in his book Good to Great, the PFA have developed a football flywheel, demonstrating the constituent parts of the game that are required to move football forward. In order to explain the concept in further detail, the PFA have assembled a discussion panel featuring soccer great John Aloisi, Chief Executive John Didlitzer, Deputy Chief Executive and former Matilda Kate Gill, Member Federation Representative Peter Philopoulos, CEO of Football Victoria, and former Herald Sun journalist David Davutovich. To complement the discussion, please visit pfa.net.au for more information on the football flywheel.
Thank you, everyone, for joining the PFA Big Ideas podcast. Very lucky today to have some wonderful people within the Australian football community join us, including one Socceroo great, one Matilda great, and one of the great administrators, and not to mention one of the great former journos or current journos, depending upon what publication is working for. So firstly, John Aloisi, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, JD. It's a pleasure.
Peter Philopoulos, current Chief Executive of Football Victoria.
Thanks, John. Looking forward to the discussion.
Former Matilda captain, Catherine Gill.
Thanks, John.
Can I refer to you as Kate, if that's okay?
You can.
Excellent. And not wishing to leave the journo to last, but I will. Mr. David Davutovich, formerly of the Herald Sun, now just a freelancer to the stars. David, thank you for making some time available for us.
I've got plenty of time at the moment, John, so absolute pleasure to be in esteemed company.
And feel free to refer to me as JD, if you like, David.
No problem.
Overtly formal, so feel free to tone it down a little bit if you like.
But I think time is what we all got on our side at the moment.
I wish I did. thanks again for joining us. I think, as John said, in the absence of the ability to discuss the minutiae of the game, you know, who's coming on, who's coming off, who beat who, it's given people a chance to step back and really discuss where we think the game can go. And these are the sort of discussions you have over coffees all the time, but it's great to be able to put them into some structured format. And what we did here at the PFA was try and build some structure around this discussion. And we developed this notion of the football flywheel that I shared with you guys earlier. Now, a flywheel isn't my invention. It's something we took from a guy called Jim Collins, who wrote a very famous book called Good to Great. It's effectively anyone who's looking to get into sports in particular, it's a book worth reading about how to take a business from being a good business to a great business. And I think it applies equally to football. And the whole notion of a flywheel is there's no, you know, specific moment of genius that unlocks the game. It's just about doing the right things to the best of your ability all the time. And at some point you get the tipping point and you get the outcomes you want, and then it becomes stronger and quicker and stronger and quicker until it becomes unstoppable. And I think with football, that's where we want to go. We want to make sure all the little moving parts of the game are working in alignment. They're year on year compounding in effectiveness until we get those really strong breakthrough moments. So we want to frame this discussion around three key areas. One is the foundation of the game. The second is the structures that we work within. and finally growth. And those things all working together, we think can lead us to where we all need to go, which is international football success. And what we've said is that the ability to be successful on the international stage is really what has the capacity to unlock the game's potential. You know, we've seen that time and time again, and it's the sort of thing that galvanizes the entire nation. It filters its way and threads its way through the entire game, and then inspires the new generation. So I'd love to get your views firstly on that point around, is international football success our end game? Is that the sort of, is that how we should be shaping all of our decisions and aspirations as a sport, John?
I think so. I think that that's how you connect with everyone playing the game. If everyone can see who their Socceroos are and Matildas and Oliveroos and actually support them at the highest level. And this is where, you know, I don't like to always go back in time and talk about, you know, the 2006. But if you chat to people, a lot of people connected with that group of players because they watch them every week, either in the Premier League, Serie A, La Liga, and then for our national team, compete against the best and actually beat some of the best in the world. So there was a real connect and there was a real sense of being part of it. And if we can create that again in terms of having international success, that will just trickle down to, you know, the amount of players and people playing the game. You know, we know that if we get the Women's World Cup here, what effect that can have for the game for future generations as well. So, you know, Matildas and Socceroos are very, very important. If they're successful, I think the game is.
Pete, you work at grassroots football. How do you see that connection happening? Is it what drives people being engaged with the game at that level?
I think the national teams play a key role because we want everyone in the grassroots when they're joining the kickoff programs. We want them to aspire to be Socceroos or Matildas. That dream of and I think our Socceroos and our Matildas, they've lost a little bit of that gloss because of mistrust in our game. And we haven't been able to, really push that value proposition and market those brands effectively. I think the Matildas and the Socceroos players have done wonders, but I think we as a sport have let them down because the way we've developed, we harnessed that value proposition and sold the dream to our grassroots. We need that grassroots to glory connection because that's what inspires a community of footballers.
Yeah. And I also get a sense it gives people a singular goal to aim for. If that's our goal is to support the Matildas, support the Socceroos, it gives us a rallying point for the game. Like Kate, as a Matilda, how influential have you seen this team evolve? Now, you started 2004, you're still involved now 15 years later. Tell us a bit about that journey and how strongly it resonated with you personally and how you saw it evolve.
I think now where the Matildas are, they've really just emerged out of the shadows. When I was playing, it was the worst kept secret. No one really knew who we were. We weren't really aspiring to be Matildas. I had no vision as a young girl to become a Matilda. I didn't even know we had a national team. So to see the progress that's been made and the visibility that those players have captured is fantastic. So if anything, I agree with Pete to some degree that I don't think the brand is publicised as well as it should be, but the players and especially the Matildas players, they've kind of come into their own and captured a fantastic audience through young girls being able to see their idols play now.
Yeah. So that in terms of then the foundation for the game, Dave, did you want to build on that a bit around, you know, what we're putting forward is that the foundation of the game is really culture. And what you do on a global stage inspires the culture, you know, football status as a global sport and all the other dimensions to it means that it can have a really rich culture. And that's really the starting point for a game. Like, what's your views on where we're at now culturally and what do we need to do in your mind to set a really strong foundation for the game's growth, you know, over the next generation?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I guess it links into what a lot of you guys have just been talking about. And I guess when you reflect, when I reflect back on my journey, and you talk and you think about, you know, the global, you know, nature of football, and you look now, for instance, at the disconnect with a lot of the young, you know, we're the number one junior participation sport in Australia, we keep hearing, but there is a massive disconnect between that junior base to the A-League, for instance. So, and I guess the W League too, but I guess probably more relevant to speak about the men's game in this instance. A big issue is a lot of these fans are following, you know, the UEFA Champions League and the big clubs overseas, Premier League, etc. So I think, you know, growing up, looking at the impact of, for instance, I remember when I was a youngster and, you know, a Ned Zelic going over to Borussia Dortmund, or, you know, a Mark Viduka making his first steps over in Europe and eventually ending in the Premier League, and Harry Kewell bursting onto the scene with Leeds United. You know, these all had a really profound impact on myself and on the Australian football community. And you know, being at the Herald Sun recently, just seeing that the impact of the stories of Aaron Moy and Matt Ryan breaking into the Premier League have had in terms of numbers and you know, the kids. And I guess the wider public, but particularly the younger kids, they really, you know, resonate with this, and it's, you know, aspirational. So, you know, I think we absolutely have to look at things globally. And, yeah, the culture is a big part of it. And also, yeah, it's something that, again, growing up, I remember watching, you know, and I had this chat with John Aloisi, I think only a few months ago, but, you know, growing up watching On the Ball on a Sunday morning, and, you know, there was a lot of, you know, discussion about, you know, and debate about, you know, the state of the game and the political side of it. But then we spoke about, you know, youth development, and then there was the Captain Socceroo side of it. And you really just got a fantastic overall grounding in terms of, I guess, the football environment, politics, you know, skill, youth development, etc. Yeah, so I think there's a real vacuum there at the moment, and it's something that absolutely needs to be addressed.
Yeah, I think one of the things we don't focus on a lot is how important football has been to shaping what modern Australia looks like. Yeah, we take for granted the sport, the role that our sport played in bringing together so many disparate communities. You know, each of us grew up through football and engaged through the broader Australian community through football, you know, regardless of what ethnic origin we had. And, you know, we often say that Australia is the world's most successful multicultural nation, but we never talk about the role that football played in achieving that. So when you talk about, you know, the inherent Australianness of Aussie rules football or rugby league, you know, the nation we are today, I reckon football, soccer has played a bigger role in who we are today as a nation than any other sport. And that's not the sort of thing we tend to value. It's not the sort of thing we tend to sell or shout from the rooftops. Like, what do you reckon, John?
I actually agree with you, JD. And we've got the opportunity to do that again, you know, especially with the refugees. And, you know, we've got Awa Mabil, that's playing with our national team again. He's playing with our national team. You've also got Thomas Ding. We are a multicultural nation, and this is the new Australia. This is the Australia that's helped the community. And a lot of the time, they come and play the game because that's what they played in their homeland. And it's a way of joining in and mixing in with the community and settling in into a new environment. And it's something that got taken away from us, JD, as you know, about 15 years ago, when everyone had to change their names, you know, from Melbourne Croatia to Melbourne Knights and all that. And I think we have to embrace that again. I'm not saying to change the names back, but what I am saying is that, you know, that we should be proud of where we've come from. We're still Australian. You know, when we play for our national team, we play for those colours. We love our country. It's the best country in the world. But we don't forget where our backgrounds come from. And that's what makes us different. And, you know, whenever you see at a World Cup, people realise that, you know, we've got different nationalities. That's why we're strong. And that's an advantage, not a disadvantage. Mm. So we have to embrace that more, I think.
Pete?
Yeah, I just think we, you know, definitely we're the most multicultural nation in the world, and I think we spent about 15 years trying to move away from football, and I'm sort of a guy that was stuck between two places. I didn't know where I belonged in 2005. I wasn't involved with the game. I was working in another sport, but when the A-League emerged, I didn't know where I belonged because I was put in that bucket of old soccer, and 2005 was new football, and I felt there was a conscious effort to try and shun the past, and this is the way forward. And, you know, I didn't really engage with any of the A-League clubs until I went to Perth, and one of the attractions of Perth was they were also in a similar position to me. They had a foot in old soccer, and they had a foot in new football. And, you know, their fans sort of represented an era that I was fond of when I was involved in the National Soccer League. And I agree with John, you know, there was a lot of positives in. The NSL wasn't a basket case entirely. There were some great elements of the National Soccer League. And talking culture, I grew up with my father and my uncles on a Sunday afternoon going to Middle Park. You want to talk about culture? You know, it was culture everywhere when you went to Middle Park on a Sunday afternoon, similar to when you went to Hindmarsh Stadium to see Adelaide City or Marconi. And I think somewhere along the way, we forgot who we are, football. I don't think we belong in Aussie rule grounds to play games. We don't belong in stadiums that are way too big for us. I think we need to go back to basics and really harness what's made us good, what's made us strong, and how we can engage the public in a more community focus. And the example I use these days is Sydney FC, with the demolishing of Allianz Stadium, has been a blessing in disguise because they've been able to engage with a whole new community by taking football to the suburbs. You know, and I think that's what we've got to replicate, you know, with football here in Australia, and engage the community from bottom up rather than aspire to trying to attract fans that aren't even remotely interested in our game. Yeah. Those armchair sports followers. We need to really get our football community, you know, supporting our game. And final point, 10 A-League clubs is not enough to engage a community of 1.96 million participants. We need to grow our footprint.
Yeah, I think that's really, really true. I think that's what we're talking about is having shared values and a shared mission for the game and landing on what they are. And I think we know those intuitively. It's always about community. It's about having pride in who you are. It's about openness. I mean, there's great stories around the late Charles Perkins, and even John Moriarty, the first Indigenous Socceroo, talks about how the football culture at the time was so open and engaging and embracing of all differences and everybody. And I think as a sport, we need to default back to that openness and that celebration that we have of our diversity. And that sort of brings me to the Matildas, because they're such a inspiring group of women. And you can, if you talk about putting that in a modern context, you know, I suppose give ourselves and Kate a pat on the back around the gender equality deal that we did for the national teams, is that's a modern twist on that. It's about, it was about saying, hey, where do we want to be as a nation? Who do we want to be? We want to be a country that empowers women, that promotes the role of women, not just as footballers, but within football generally. And that was a powerful statement to again, bring the demonstrate that football had a broader a role to play within the community. Kate, did you want to speak a bit to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. I think what we managed to achieve with the framework that we set for the Matildas, I mean, it was built on those universal principles of diversity and inclusion, which we mentioned, but it was also about delivering opportunity, fairness, and a genuine partnership for our female players. And it even goes one step further, as it's about women in football. So while the players are an integral part of that, it's how we build this framework out and expand it so that all females that want to be involved in football, be that as an administrator, as a young player, that their journey and their pathway can be inclusive.
It's like culture is not just about looking back, it's about looking forward and about who you want to be, you know. And Dave, did you want to chime in?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. But I think to your point, John, it's, if you go back, football has just historically been so poor at telling these stories, you know, when you compare it to, NRL and particularly the AFL, who are just so good at, you know, they've got their themed grounds and these sorts of things, and there's complete buy-in. But I mean, John Moriarty and Charles Perkins, the late Charles Perkins, are great cases in point. I mean, such powerful stories that have just been completely almost glossed over by football, you know, and who do you point the finger at? I mean, who's ultimately responsible for telling these stories? That's a $1 million question. But, you know, and to Kate's point about the Matildas, and when you look at, you know, in recent times, the Matildas really have been, you know, the agenda setter in perhaps the Australian women's sports movement and globally also. But as a game, I think we've been real agenda setters over the journey. You know, even if you go back to 1977, the National Soccer League was the first truly national competition in Australia. But we've been really poor at, I guess, carrying on that narrative and I guess really exploiting it. So absolutely have to look forward. But I think, you know, in all of these areas, we have to sort of, I guess, reflect now, and it's a perfect time to reflect and, you know, review, learn from, I guess, all the mistakes and some of the good things that have happened and take it forward from there.
Yeah. I always use the phrase is of using history as a sword, not a shield. You know, you need to use your history as something that can help you get ahead, you know, rather than being a defensive position as if to say, well, we've always done it this way, so not going to change. Let's embrace your history so that you can evolve and effectively tell your story. And a big part of that is making sure that we're open as a football community. So, you know, making sure we get really great people within the game and then encourage them to speak their mind, that we're not defensive, that we're not, we don't close our minds to the views of different people, but we can reflect without fear and hopefully use that to stimulate ideas and the direction of the game, you know?
I think that's starting to happen, JD. I think finally we're starting to embrace that and actually speak our mind and be open. And, you know, it was great the other night when we were able to get six of the, you know, us, the ex-teammates together and just speak openly and not be afraid of, we all want the same thing. We want the game to grow and we want the game to get better. I know, Dave, you've been involved in, you know, filming, you know, the old clubs, you know, Macedonia and, you know, the Croatian heritage and all that. And it's been great because people do forget about the history. Let's embrace the history, move forward with it and not, you know, just hide it.
And to bring a couple of those things together, Dave, sorry to cut in, is, you know, you talk about soccer, or at the time soccer being at the forefront by being the first national competition. The real impetus for that was the 74 World Cup. So it was again this ability to achieve on the global stage that drives people's creativity and energy and inspiration. And then you see this domestic glow, you know. So that's again another really good strong story as to why it's so important that we set ourselves up not to worry about competing with the AFL, for example. We've got to compete with the rest of the world. We're going to make sure that our deeds can be played out on the global stage, because that's the only way that I think we can be successful.
Yeah. And I agree with you, John. I mean, like, for me, you know, we often, ever since I've come back to the grassroots game, I've often heard our government doesn't support football. You know, they're only interested in AFL. They're only interested in, you know, NRL. You know, what I found is that we haven't been great at building our narrative, you know, picking up on David's point. You know, we've done a lot of work with government here in Victoria in terms of articulating, you know, what the need is. And you know, we've built a strong narrative. We've unlocked about $200 million worth of, you know, facilities funding for Victoria for football. And because we were able to build a strong narrative and a strong platform which resonated with government. And what government has told me often is that, you know, we're such a fractious, sport, you know, and I've been involved in other sports. And, you know, the AFL, they don't have as authentic narrative as football. You know, yeah, we're the multicultural sport. The AFL work hard at, you know, and I joke about this. They've got a multicultural department, all of, you know, comprising of all white people from private school backgrounds who have no idea about multiculturalism. Yet here on our call here, we're rich in multiculturalism, you know, and and we've tried to shun it. What we need is a unity of purpose and a united narrative, a collective narrative, and really build credibility bottom up. And, you know, unless we start with culture, you know, in terms of how, what the cornerstone, you know, the keystone values that we want to live by, you know, we're not going to be able to, you know, develop a strong strategy. And that's got to start with, what does the winning look like? What does the picture of success look like for football? And we need to build a culture to try and build a strategy, you know, in addition to that culture, to get us to the next phase. And, you know, what I loved about the other day, you know, on the Optus Sport, and I listened to it on my walk on Sunday for 2 hours. That was the fastest walk I've ever done, which was lasted for 2 hours, because it was fantastic. I was so enthused by listening to people, and there was, you know, differences of opinion there, you know, and the only way we're going to get, you know, progress as a sport is that we've got to build an architecture of trust as a sport, because there's so much mistrust in every layer, on all, in all components, and we need to do that. We need to build that culture and that narrative and the strategy to win the credibility across the board, because we've got so much that we can achieve. We've got something that the other sports don't. The NRL, in terms of grassroots participation, are in dire straits. You know, a rugby union, dire straits. AFL, it's not as pretty as what they make out. They're great at building narrative, which sometimes is a house of cards. We've got the narrative. We have got a participation base. Just in Victoria alone, we grew 24% in 2018 and 30% in 2019. That's enormous numbers that other sports would love. But we need to find a way forward with a unity of purpose.
Peter, I think that's what you're saying is exactly right. And you talk about being fractured, and we've been fractured for a number of years and disjointed in terms of, and you might not like this, but, you know, we've got the 9 boards really that we have to go through to pass something through, you know, the member feds and the FFA. It's difficult. And JD, you'd probably be able to touch more on this because you've been involved in at all levels, but it just seems like it's impossible or hard work to pass something through because of this.
It's a good segue, John. I mean, it's a good segue to the notion of structure. So if we say that our foundation is culture, and we've got to get our culture right, and the unity of purpose that Pete spoke about, and embracing who we are and telling that story, I think the next step is then how you do that, and that's the structures you have. Yeah. And I think the 3 key structures are governance, pathways, and competition design, and we'll speak about each of those. But we'll start with governance, and that builds on your point, John, is how do we switch, or do we switch to a national operating model? And that's not to say we, you know, wake up tomorrow and we wind up, you know, every state federation, but how do we work more effectively so that we have a seamless and unified mission across the whole game, Pete? You work it every day. How do we, how do you find this federated structure, and how can we do it more effectively so that, you know, we're singing from the same hymn sheet?
That's right. Well, it's a good conversation, you know, because look, what I say is that with the unity of purpose, you know, the structures, I won't go into that. I haven't got an opinion one way or another, but how do we, you know, if you look at
you can talk openly here. It's amongst friends.
Get off the fence, Pete.
What I will say is, though, whether it's, there's 2 things to that point, right? Collectively, 9 federations have got net assets on the balance sheet, which is quite lucrative. It's a big number. When you combine that capital and the net assets on their balance sheet, it's a big number.
Right? How much was it, Kate? Do you know roughly?
Was it somewhere around 8-9 mil?
80-90 mil.
Well, that's taken a hit with COVID-19, right? Yeah. And if you look at the balance sheet of the FFA, you know, there's not much there at all. So one point is, how do we use our collective capital as a sport to make it work harder? You know? And then the other piece is, I think FFA, you know, has an opportunity to be the leaders, you know, and lead and build a narrative to engage the member federations on how we can work better. Because I agree with you, having 9 different strategies, at the moment, we don't have a national strategy as a sport. We don't have a national strategy. You know, then hopefully now with James Johnson on board, a good football person, we'll build that strategy, which is a national strategy. And if we can build a national strategy, how do we localise that national strategy in each market? And how do we use our collective resources and our capability to achieve that strategy. And that requires strong leadership and strong narrative. So when people say about the nine federations, get rid of the federations, yeah, look, that's fine. That's a conversation that can be had. My point is, how can we make it work better for us by combining our collective capital, combining our resources, our IP, and build a national strategy which we can localise in each market, because we're a big continent. How do you reach every corner of Australia and engage your constituents?
Yeah. So just to provide some background on that, just for people who aren't acquainted with that, each state obviously has their own autonomous, independent voice or institution, including Northern New South Wales. So we have two in New South Wales. Both the territories have their own federation, and effectively each can operate as autonomously as they wish. There are some broad parameters, but in essence, they run their own businesses and are accountable to themselves and their boards and their constituents, as opposed to the broader game. Dave, did you have any thing to add to that in terms of the governance? What we call grassroots governance?
Well, yeah, governance, governments. I mean, you know, further to Pete's point earlier, I guess, and your point, JD, I mean, I guess if you put yourself in the government's shoes, state government, I mean, with AFL, there's one voice continually coming to you, asking for money, you know, liaising about, you know, different scenarios and you know, and joint ventures and whatnot. Whereas with football, I mean, you can have 5-6 different stakeholders coming to you, you know, almost cap in hand saying, you know, help us out. It can be the FFA. Let's use Victoria as an example. You've got FFA, Football Federation Victoria. You've got several A-League clubs here in Melbourne. Victory recently went through a scenario with where there was some government funding there for their own facility. You know, you've got expansion clubs, you've got private, you know, groups asking for money. So put yourself in the government's shoes, and of course it's going to be overwhelming. Compare it to AFL, as I said, and you know, NRL is obviously a lot more cohesive and organised as well. So it's absolutely critical to get unity and leadership from the top end. And certainly if you learn from, I mean, for me, the AFL is the best run sport / organisation in Australia, and they do polarise opinion. But, you know, the turning point in that sport, I thought, was when they really took a national outlook on things sort of in the late 80s, early 90s. And I think that sort of coincided with the winding up of the federated model. So, you know, whether that's the path that, you know, football needs to choose and how that's done, I'm not sure. But certainly, you know, whilst we need to look global, there are, you know, some areas where we can look at other sports such as AFL to learn some lessons.
Yeah, I won't sit on the fence here, JD. I think that it has to change, because it, like I said before, and Dave just mentioned, we've got too many people going to from different areas to the government. So the government are going to say, well, no, they've already been asked or whatever. Up here in Queensland, you have Football Queensland, then you also have Brisbane Football, then you have the Church League. So you've got different organisations just in a small area. Now, I think that it doesn't mean getting rid of the offices there. It doesn't mean that, you know, Victoria don't have their office and people running that region, because their region is different to New South Wales, different to Queensland. You have different issues in terms of travel in Queensland because of how big it is and how large the state is. But there still has to be one overarching the leader, which it should be the FFA.
Yeah, I think we have to make a decision. Do we want a strong national governing body who can dictate policy, or do we want nine independently strong state feds? I don't think you can have both. I think that's what the last phase of our evolution has taught us. I think that's what COVID's taught us, is that there's no need to have the model that we have. It doesn't achieve any doesn't unlock any significant value for the sport. I mean, recently there is an example within Australia where sailing went from ostensibly this federated model into a more singular national operating model, and they went through that process for 3-4 years, and then did a little research analysis of it. And they found they had, you know, really significant benefits switching away from that federated model of governance into a more streamlined national operating model. And I think there's a compelling case now, to at least for us to look at that formally, rather than just have these sort of side conversations about it. Let's actually do the work to find out if that sort of an approach is in the game's best interest and what value it might unlock. Otherwise, we'll be having this conversation in another 20 years. The next time there's an issue, we'll revisit it.
And I'm hearing Tennis Australia are going to do the same in June, July, that they're going to implement the same. So, you know, obviously there's something behind it, or else people would stick to the federated governance at the moment.
Tennis has got a lot of very similar issues, a real power struggle between the states and ultimately the national body. So I've got no doubt if they can sort that out, that game could explode even further.
The next part of governance for me, so there's two points. It's called the grassroots or the national structure. The other one's the relationship that exists between the federation and the professional leagues. Now, we all know that's been going on now for 3-4 years, that process of migrating the leagues out. And I think if COVID has shown us anything, it's that we've struggled with that process. And I think there's probably a crying need at the moment to establish an independent commission to run the professional leagues under license from FFA. And the sooner we get into that space, the better. And that again joins best practice from around the world. Kate, did you have any views on that at all?
I think moving forward, independence is paramount. I think it's really hard if we were to operate where the clubs were in control of that, and for them to nominate their own board, the level of self-interest that would sit alongside with that would just bring more harm to the game. So I definitely think moving forward, that should be the first protocol.
Pete, you worked at club level for a while, man. What's your views on where the governance of the league should sit?
I think that there's a big disparity in performance standards in the A-League. And that is because of the, big range of different investments at club land. And the question I have around independence, I agree it needs to be, my belief it needs to be independent, is because who's going to upkeep the performance standards? And, you know, the investment is required to run a professional team. You know, that was my challenge at Perth Glory, and, you know, that we needed to diversify revenue. And one of the first things I had to do was grow the membership base. We grew it from, 4,600 members to 11,000 very quickly. And that was because we needed to unlock new revenue to be able to invest more in the two professional teams we were running and the academy. And, we simply can't find enough money to invest in our high performance our high performance environments. And my question is, who's going to uphold the performance standards? And that's where we need to be strong with building high standards in our top tier competition. And that requires investment, and that requires some very strong decisions, very strong, bold decisions, and someone to be the leader to enforce them.
Dave, did you want to build on that? You've got a good helicopter view of this. Having worked in the media.
The old helicopter. I think it's a great idea, the, independent board commission, whatever you want to call it. Again, I referenced the AFL. I think it's worked wonders for them. The A-League owners, I honestly believe they're well-intentioned, but they need help. They're not sure where to go and how to get there. And it's just this really awkward time in the game at the moment. And I think you nailed it the other day, JD, where, you mentioned, I think it was on ABC, that, COVID-19 has really come at a really tenuous time for the game. And, with this, the Fox Sports deal's the elephant in the room, and that's basically why the A-League hasn't gone fully independent yet. So everyone's sort of, dancing around this issue. No one's really standing up and taking responsibility. Now, look at Peter Vlandis, the the ARL chairman. I mean, he has taken the bull by the horns during this crisis, the pandemic, and you know they've had issues. I mean, Channel 9, their broadcaster, has publicly come out and slammed the NRL, but they've obviously got on with the job and you know, putting plans in place to resume in life after coronavirus. So look, I think there is self-interest is a big issue in the game. I think it's something that's holding the game back at many levels. But, you know, I think the owners, sometimes like a single decision that may even adversely affect the club, once aggregated, it'll benefit the overall game and that club in particular. And I think that's where, you know, an independent voice, an independent board would really help the game move forward.
John, you worked across three clubs. Like, how do you see the league best functioning, and what do you think of the capacity of clubs to genuinely step out of their own self-interest and make decisions in the best interest of the broader game and the broader league?
It's very hard for them, JD, because they've invested a lot of money and they keep on investing a lot of money. So I can understand where they're coming from. But for the best interest of the game, we do need an independent commission because, you know, we can go back to, and I won't name names, but I remember when, you know, national team players were getting called up and, you know, certain club owners would go, oh, we don't care about the national team. That's got nothing to do with us. Well, our whole conversation at the beginning of the show was about our national teams doing well. So if we've got our club owners saying that they don't care, now how's that beneficial for the overall game? So we do need an independent commission. We do need to actually get someone in that's very strong and that can actually push the clubs to a certain level and even can go and you know, Dave spoke about the elephant in the room about Fox Sports. All right, so now how are we going to present a product to a new broadcaster when our product at the moment's not great? So we need to restructure, and I'm sure that, JD, you'll end up going into that. We need to restructure the A-League a little bit and immediately, you know, start to add teams and connect with, you know, the older teams that have been around for 60-odd years. I think that's a way you'll be able to connect very quickly with the grassroots again, and also if you've got a promotion relegation. Now, financially, I'm not across how it would work. Peter might be able to say a little bit more about it, but already you start to create interest because it would be the only code in Australia that would have a promotion relegation. And how good would that be? That's then a product that you can sell.
John, just to go back on the point you made about the club owners not caring about the national teams. Again, you know, this is where, you know, whether it's the head of the commission or whoever it may be, I mean, it is, for me, it is so clear how the national teams can help the clubs. I mean, ultimately, the national teams, particularly the youth national teams, for instance, they're there to ultimately develop players, help the development of individual players. So if, you know, Australia is qualifying for World Youth Cups and players are having breakout tournaments and then they get scouted by overseas clubs, it's the clubs that are going to benefit here in the A-League with big transfer fees. I mean, England was a great case in point with their under-17 and their under-20 World Cup success. Off the back of that, there was a lot of movement with those players, Jadon Sancho over to Borussia Dortmund, etc. So, you know, for instance, Daniel Arzani getting picked for the 2018 World Cup squad. Yeah, he already had interest from overseas, but him making that squad and getting minutes over at the World Cup meant that, you know, the interest levels obviously skyrocketed. Now, he ended up being sold to, you know, within the City Football Group, but there was no less than 15 or 20 other offers for Arzani. So that for me is a very basic one, but it's a case of to the point of this whole discussion, a unified, I guess, approach and yeah, narrative.
That's a good segue, David, to like the next pillar of this notion of structures from our perspective is pathways. And pathways work at two levels. You know, one is the pathway of young player into the Australian elite pathways, if you like, or the elite part of the game. But then there's also the step from the Australian the elite within Australian football to the global stage. And that's something, that ladder is something we've struggled with in recent times. You know, we've done a lot of research on that and how the match minutes of Australian players have diminished over time. And, you know, we can talk, we'll talk about next how the Australian process can get better. But one thing that I've, you know, one of our big ideas for people to knock over is the notion of how do we build value in Australian players in the global market? And the reality is you're not going to sell Australian players for global dollars out of Australia. There's just no evidence of that happening. You know, the example I use is Aaron Moy. If Aaron Moy, and we had a lot of offers for him when I was at Melbourne City, but Aaron Moy in a Melbourne City shirt was always going to be worth less than $1 million. That's a reality. If you put exactly the same player in a Dinamo Zagreb or an Anderlecht or a FC Twente,
you're multiplied by five.
Is worth 5 or 10 times as much. Yeah. And so one of the wacky ideas we had was buying clubs in Europe. You know, we have a lot of Australian people who are interested in investing in football, not necessarily the A-League. We've seen that through last bidding processes. Why can't we put together a business plan that allows us to buy clubs in Europe and then finally give our players and our coaches and our support staff a legitimate platform to prove that they're as good as everybody else in the world? And if that team has, or that club has success, then watch the value of our assets, quote unquote, go through the roof. You know, and no one in Europe's going to hire Ange Postecoglou. Yet, I reckon if you ask 99% of Australians, he's the best coach they've seen work. No one was prepared to pay more than $1 million for Aaron Moy. Yet, 12 months at Huddersfield, and he became a £20 million player, or $20 million player. So, I think that's a sort of lateral thinking we need to look at, and how we can magnify and build value in Aussies abroad, because that's where you prove your worth. And if we prove our worth at that stage, then the rising tide lifts all boats. You know, every player in Australia and every coach in Australia and every administrator in Australia will be worth more.
I think it's a massive idea. It's very lateral, but I think it's a great discussion point. And if that could somehow be executed, it would be, you know, it could have a profound effect on Australian football. I mean, John Aloisi is probably better served to discuss this than I am. But from my discussions with people, John, your era back in the 90s, even, you know, the early to mid 2000s, it wasn't hard to get a trial for an Australian player overseas. In fact, in a lot of cases, overseas clubs would pay for the player to come over and trial. Aussie players had really good reputations. Now, it's difficult even getting a trial at a club. So, for whatever reason, the reputation of Australian players has definitely dropped off. And in terms of like the guys who have gone overseas, even in the last few years, I mean, it's not as if there's overseas scouts bashing down the door in the A-League and coming here watching games. Often it's agents working hard in the background to facilitate those deals. Quite often it's also these players representing Australia at youth tournaments overseas, be it qualifiers or friendly tournaments. I know Jacob Italiano is an example. And in his instance, I think he was may have been playing under 20s as a 17-year-old. And that's another appeal for overseas clubs, finding, you know, players that are a little bit younger. So, look, they're all challenges at the moment, which we need to discuss. But, I mean, having some equity in an overseas club could have a profound effect. And I'll tell you what, just speaking to a few people overseas in the last couple of days, there's plenty of clubs on offer at the moment, plenty of owners looking to offload.
John, that question that you mentioned, you know, I'll just pick up first the discussion around the Australian Institute of Sport. Back in the 90s and 80s, when that was really working, all of those graduates were coming from clubs, going into the AIS, then coming back out of the AIS into the NSL clubs, playing first team football. For whatever reason, the AIS of late wasn't producing the first team footballers. They weren't coming back to their A-League teams playing first team football. And I think The reason being there were more opportunities back in the NSL days for some reason. You know, we had less participants but more opportunities for senior football. I still struggle with the notion that we've only got 10 professional A-League teams. So are we providing enough opportunities for our aspiring young footballers with 10 Australian A-League teams? I would think not.
I think, Pete, the problem with that is if no one's looking at Australia to start with, then it doesn't matter how many players you got here.
Yeah.
I think that's where we're at now. It's the Australian, the perception.
Sorry to interrupt. There's a number of issues that I think that we can speak about. We can go now into the actual salary cap. The clubs will only end up signing players on 1-2 year deals.
Yeah.
So that also it makes it easier for an overseas club to go, well, no problem, we'll let you go within a year and then we'll take them for free. So there's all these issues that are involved. With the AIS, they started to take them in a lot younger, Pete. So they were only like 15, 16. So they were coming out of there just as they were turning 17. So they probably weren't quite ready. Whereas when we were there, we're coming out at 17 and a half, 18. And so you were already mature enough to play the NSL. But I understand there's not enough teams. So this is a time and an opportunity to restructure the A-League and order and go to 16 teams straight away. And that way there, we've got an opportunity. And I think that if you get rid of the salary cap, the clubs will find their feet in terms of what they can spend and can't spend, I believe. And all of a sudden, the clubs will actually sign players on longer-term deals, JD. So when they do go to a Youth World Cup or when they do go to an Olympics, which we qualified for, then it's a lot harder then for them to actually sign them because they're on longer term deals. So they have to spend that little bit more money. I'm not saying it will be millions, but I'm saying it will be more than what it is now.
Yeah, particularly
Go, John.
No, you're right, Dave.
I was going to say, back to the point about, looking at overseas clubs potentially, and earlier about just looking globally, more broadly speaking. I mean, going back to that chat that you guys had on Optus Sport the other day, John, I mean, six of the Socceroos' golden generation, Mark Viduka based in Croatia, Vince Grella based in Italy, Mark Schwarzer based in London. We've got some unbelievable football IQ overseas. And, guys who are obviously invested in the game emotionally and would definitely be willing to get involved in, some way, shape or form, I would have thought. I mean, Harry Kewell's over there, Tim Cahill's over there, Paul Okon's over in Belgium at the moment. I mean, we've got so much, football IP over there that we don't really tap into. We don't really know how to tap into. And, yeah, I mean, like a club overseas, for instance, I know it's quite, quite radical, but, something like that, obviously there's a lot of potential spin-offs there in terms of a quasi, home of football for Australia, for Socceroos, for Australian youth teams, for the Matildas, etc. So, I just think it's fascinating and something that absolutely should be explored. And when you go back to the last expansion process, I mean, there was about $100 million on the table, if not more, that was basically knocked back. So I'm sure there would, potentially be people interested in getting involved. And, overseas clubs at the moment, I mean, you could get pretty reasonable clubs from what I can gather for, around the 5 million euro mark as an entry point, so potentially even less now in light of this global pandemic. So certainly worth exploring.
Yeah, some of the themes you guys touched on fit within this notion of competition design, which is another key structure. Like, how do we set up our leagues so that we're producing the best players, we're connecting with as many fans as possible geographically and culturally? And that's really important we get that right. How does the A-League define itself as a proposition? How does each club design its own brand so that it resonates with its local community? So these are things we've probably got an opportunity now to reset a bit. Within that, what's the role of the W League and women's football within the competition design? Kate, in terms of the way we design our competitions around women's football, like, where do you think that needs to go?
I think what we achieved with the W League or have done We were kind of at the forefront of where women's football sat in the global landscape. I think now bigger clubs have kind of cottoned on to that there's value in the women's proposition, and you see the global enticingness of our players heading overseas. So it's almost how do we redirect them back to here, or how we make it a synergy between playing in the W League and keeping players here, but also them being able to earn a living and a livelihood being overseas as well. So in saying that, I think we were progressive at one point, but we've almost been asleep at the wheel and now we've lost a bit of direction. But that has to become an integral conversation when we move forward for the state of the game in this country as to how we keep making progress with the W League.
If you had a blank sheet of paper, how would you get the clubs to structure their women's programs?
Good question. Yeah, it would definitely be a year-round proposition, and that might be moving alongside the state federations as well. So it could technically sit with the professional clubs and the member federations to make sure that we can harness the potential and keep it as a year-round proposition.
Yeah. John, you spoke earlier about expanding the A-League to 16 teams. What do you think the key benefits of that are? Because, I mean, I think there's the opportunities right for that. I reckon there's a real chance now that, I suppose, the financial barriers to entry may have dropped a bit. You're probably opening the doors for a few geographic locations that we may have knocked back previously. There's an opportunity now to more closely integrate the NPL or second tier structures into the way the A-League operates. And you've also got maybe a chance to develop a zonal Y-League. Like, what's your view of how all those things need to intersect and work another?
Well, look, what I'm hearing that if Fox Sports don't pay the next installment, then this season won't be played at all. So the end of this season would be, now I'm not privy to all conversations, so I don't know, but then that gives us time to actually structure or restructure our A-League and / second division and then underneath that. So what I mean about four teams now, I'm not necessarily saying that there has to be four new teams. I'm saying that there might be like current NPL teams, you know, either in New South Wales, Queensland, Victoria, South Australia, that have financially got capability and they've got a structure within their club that could automatically join the A-League. And, you know, it might be that even it's a playoff, you know, just to see who ends up getting in there. So, you know, there might be the Northern and Southern actually having a playoff and the two, you know, best teams from each region end up going into this new reformed A-League. And then underneath that, the second tier, you would have existing NPL clubs that you would have to have a Northern League and a Southern League. And then, you know, you're talking about the Y-League underneath could be the lower tier NPL clubs with Y-League sides in there from the A-League. Because if you go over to Spain, Portugal, and a lot of those countries, their second teams are playing in a third division comp. So that's a way of them developing their own players from within that group there. And so when they do end up playing enough games or they're at a level, they don't even need to go out on loan. They're ready straight away to get into the first team. So, you know, when I was at Osasuna B, we're in the third division. And when the player was good enough, we didn't even loan him out. He was ready for our first team. And that happens with Barcelona B, Real Madrid B. So all these clubs have got it. And I think that's a way forward. I don't know if it's financially viable to do, but it's something that we do have to discuss. And if we can implement it now, now's the best time to do that.
And I think it's important. I mean, the economic stuff's always critical. I mean, it's absolutely fundamental that any decisions you make are economically sound or financially sound. But surely the starting point is designing what's optimal in a footballing context. Okay, what's the best thing for our players and what's the best thing for our clubs to succeed? And then you work out how to manage that economically. Like Pete, you've lived this at the coalface. What's some of your views on, you know, rapid fire expansion and the relationship that exists between A-League clubs and the current second tier clubs and how we can better integrate those two? Because it's not always easy, is it?
No, it's not. And in some ways, I'll say this bravely, I think the broadcast deal made us lazy as a sport, to be honest. And I think, look, it'd be good if Fox stood by us because I think it's a great product. I'd even be happy for a Channel 9 on Channel 7 to make a brave decision and divest from some of their other sports and invest in our product. But the problem we have is there is a lack of incentive, or sorry, a lack of reward for those who invest appropriately, and a lack of penalty for those who aren't. And for me, again, it goes back to not enough professional teams in our ecosystem. And I would love to see our A-League go to 16 automatically, and then have a 14-team second tier as well. And, you know, it might not be automatic promotional relegation in the first instance. I like John's idea about maybe a playoff in the first instance to test the second tier. And for me, that drives the worst performers consistently are going to be driven by different motivation. At the moment, there's no penalty, you know, for anyone who doesn't invest appropriately in their clubs and doesn't make the right decisions. There's no penalty. You know, watching programs, you know, on Netflix like, you know, Sunderland Till I Die and Class of 92. I mean, that, what great stories they are, you know, and that's why English football is where it's at, because it is about rewarding everybody along the ecosystem, even the lower tiers.
Or punishing.
Yeah, or punishing.
Or punishing.
I agree.
Yeah. But even the lower tiers, there's not enough incentive or reward for the lower tiers to develop talent anymore, you know, because they're taken away from them with no reward whatsoever. You know, unless we develop that and create more opportunities, not just for players, let's not forget the coaches we've developed, you know, and the opportunities we'll be able to provide them. You know, if South Melbourne, when I was there, didn't give a young 30-year-old Ange Postecoglou an opportunity, quite bravely, right, where would Ange be today? You know, and that's because we had opportunities back then to do that. You know, we need to open up those opportunities. The Arthur Pappas's of this world, you know, to be able to get him his opportunity. You know, the John Aloisi's at the moment who hopefully will be coaching a team soon, right? But, you know, we need those opportunities and we need incentives and reward. And I think this is the time. We need 16 teams. And I think we need to, you know, give the opportunity for some of the NPL teams, those who can step up, the opportunity to demonstrate what they can do. They can certainly talk a big game in terms of what they can do. Let's give them the opportunity to do that, to demonstrate what they can do by this system. Yeah, and this is the opportunity.
JD, we spoke about, and Peter makes great points in terms of having an incentive to be successful, to win, to produce players. So then clubs actually, you know, if we sell players overseas, yeah, you know, that's a way to generate income back into their club. But, you know, also relegation, you know, we're talking about producing players to go play at the highest level. Now, if you can make them harden before they go overseas, and what I mean by harden, I mean that, you know, have their successes, but also have their failures, because there's nothing worse than getting relegated, believe me. And there's nothing more exciting than getting promoted or winning a championship. So, you know, you're already giving them that that experience before they go over, because when they go over to play in the Premier League, and you probably can speak to Aaron Moy what it's like, you know, to get relegated. I can tell you what it was like. It was the worst feeling in the world. You're setting foot onto the pitch and you know, you can't even feel your legs because there's so much pressure involved in that game, involved in those moments, because the whole city is counting on it. If we can start to create that here, not only are we going to produce better players, we're going to create passionate supporters like Sunderland supporters, because there's so much riding on it. At the moment, there's nothing riding on Central Coast Mariners coming last. Who cares? No one cares. They don't care. And at the moment, that's not the way to produce elite athletes or elite footballers or even supporters that are passionate.
Dave, did you have any wrap up on this, the notion of the competition design?
Yeah, look, I'm all for expansion. I've been on the record numerous times as saying that, you know, we need to continue expanding. I think our expansion, well, I wouldn't even call it a strategy. I don't think there's been an expansion strategy since we started. Each phase of expansion in the A-League process has been ad hoc. You know, North Queensland Fury, Gold Coast, Melbourne Heart, which is now Melbourne City, then... Well, that's one of the. I'm literally going through all the clubs one by one, but that is one of the success stories. Now, I know that club struggled and had its challenges over the journey, but again, lessons can be learned from that. But the club's still there, and that club actually attracted investment from the City Football Group. They paid $11.25 million, and you know they're one of what only three or four clubs that have still kept their players on and are paying them as far as I'm aware. So, you know, for all the criticism and faults, etc., they've actually brought something positive to the game. But, you know, Western Sydney Wanderers happened off the back of, you know, Gold Coast blowing up and more recently Western United. So I think, look, a bold strategic plan for expansion, I think, is necessary. Again, like as Kate discussed with, you know, the Matildas and the women's movement, Tasmania was a discussion that football started, but the AFL has gone on with, and now they've set up all sorts of committees about expanding there. Now, I reckon the first sport that genuinely expands into Tasmania, I think there'll be some great commercial benefits for them. And unfortunately, I don't think Football FFA has had any meaningful discussions with the people from Tasmania over the, you know, the 18 months since that expansion decision was made. So I absolutely think we need to continue expanding. I absolutely think we need to look at a second division as well as promotion relegation. It's difficult for that to happen overnight, but let's get the wheels in motion. Let's put plans in place, because once we do add promotion relegation, whether it's 3 or 4 or 5 years' time, I agree with you, boys. It would be bloody exciting, and it would be the real point of difference.
Mm-hmm. John. Yeah,
Jay, the question for you. The licences that are currently in place that the A-League clubs have got, have they got something in there that they can't get relegated for a number of years? Do you know exactly what's in these licences?
Yeah, the club participation agreements have always featured the capacity for promotion and relegation to be introduced, I think. I don't have the document in front of me, but there's always been that scope. I mean, because it's always been mooted by FIFA, or certainly mentioned within FIFA regulations, that that's their preferred model of league design to have promotion and relegation. They've always kept the door open for that. So I think it's, you know, it's certainly not something that's necessarily prohibited by the license agreements. But I think it is really important as a principle to preserve the capital of the existing owners and give them the incentive to invest in their clubs. And I think that's where the tension comes. If we're seeing owners aren't investing in their clubs, then they almost lose the privilege of retaining elite status. You know, so with that elite status comes a responsibility, and that responsibility is meeting a base level of professionalism, making sure you've got a base level of coaching competency, a base level of investment in players. Now, if owners stop reaching that threshold, then I don't think that they have a right to preserving their capital at all costs, because it comes at a huge cost to the Australian game. So I think it's really important that we do try and preserve the investment these owners have put into the game. But if they're not prepared to bring it up to a base level, then they're almost losing that privilege. And then I think that the other really key thing on competition design is we actually need to develop a very clear identity of what the A-League and the W-League is. You know, so we've got to say, okay, we've got to accept that maybe we have to be skewed towards, you know, really exciting Australian talent. Maybe we have to be skewed towards being this uber community-focused league. Now, because the reality is it's going to be increasingly challenging for us to compete with the top leagues of the world. And a lot of good traditional footballing countries have pivoted away from trying to be the best and said, we're going to be the best at what we want to be at. The best at what we want to do. So an Ajax said, we're going to stop trying to be the champions of Europe and produce the best young players in Europe. And they're reaping the rewards of that. And a lot of clubs in Holland and Belgium in particular have done that. So I think the first step for us from the league perspective is say, who do we want to be? Well, what do we want the A-League and W-League to be? And then build accordingly. Now, that sort of segues into this final section is this notion of growth. And that's about how do we grow the game? And I think what we've said, there's two key areas to growing the game. One is the commercialization of the game, and the other is sustainability. And I want to touch on sustainability first. And want to talk about sustainability. We talk about, I think, access to the sport, making sure that we get as many players having access to the game, making sure that there's enough infrastructure available to players, making sure that there's enough coaches to go around. And then the other part of it is, I think for me, is making sure that we sustain a good footballing culture, that we're not perceived. I think too often we get these really big football numbers because we're a default sport. So mums and dads are looking at sports to put their kids in, and they've got this smorgasbord of choices, and they go to the least offensive. And, oh, let's put our kid into soccer because we don't want him hit too hard, or we don't want him hit across the head. It's safe. So, which is great, but we need to be able to move it away from being a default sport and making sure these people become fall in love with the game the same way we have. And that way the game actually grows organically, and we produce a sustainable participation base and a sustainable supporter base. So I think for me, I'd love to discuss, I think things like fees are important in that context. Facilities are important in that context. And how we work with government is really important in that context too. So Pete, did you want to share some views in that regard?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we need to back ourselves in and really back ourselves in strategically. And, you know, the cost of football, that's one we need to look at really closely. But at the moment, you know, across the country, we have got a shortage on facilities. So our sport, this is fact, are knocking back kids from playing sport, playing football, because we just don't have enough facilities. And that's one area I've spent a lot of time with our board here in Victoria, and we've had enormous success. And the number of projects currently live and coming on online now is incredible. And that's going to help us grow further and harness our growth to heights where, you know, never ever has seen any other sport in this country. And I really believe in that. I think there's an opportunity to nationalise that. And in terms of your question about unlocking a lot more revenue, definitely we need a lot more revenue in our football ecosystem. And that's only going to come by us really articulating our value proposition as a sport, how we, you know, harness the intellectual property, our assets and our brands like Matildas, A-League, W-League, Socceroos, you know, how we look at all of the assets we have, how do we unlock value in those assets? Because I think there's a lot of latent value in the Matildas and the Socceroos, you know, and we need to do that exercise. I think it's a brand strategy, a deep brand strategy to connect the grassroots to the Matildas. Every little girl playing football should be aspiring to be a Matilda, Samantha Kerr, Catherine Gill. Every young boy should be aspiring to be a Socceroo, you know, and how do we unlock value in that brand and trying to find the right fit multinational brand to attach to our brand. Who's going to leverage it? Who's going to leverage it hard? There's opportunities because we're going to need to invest in our high performance. You know, I'm sure Graham Arnold wants more resources in running the Socceroos, Ante Milicic to run the Matildas. And we need more money to do that, and we need to unlock it very quickly. And I think we've got latent value in our existing assets and brands and IP, and I think we haven't even created value in new assets, IP and brands, and we need to work harder. And facilities is a big one. I think we can, you know, when I was growing up, you know, I'm a little bit older than some of you, I'm not that much older, but I remember driving around the suburbs of Victoria, you know, of Melbourne. You couldn't see soccer pitches. You drive around now, and we are every year we're getting more and more and more facilities, and we're getting more kids playing the sport. So we should be. I think there's an expectation for us as a football fraternity to do a better job, and we need to unlock that latent value in our ecosystem to be able to invest in high performance outcomes. And I'm really passionate about that, and that's what we need to do.
You've seen this very much as a player coming through, as a leading female player, the lack of investment in women's football, and what it means then to get investment in the game. Do you want to talk a bit about that journey and the difference it made for you to have investment in your pathway?
Yeah, definitely. And I agree with Peter on the way that he's talking about these latent assets and what we have already in the game. And for me, sustainability also sits with scalability and being efficient in what you do. And I think this whole flywheel concept proved to that. So once you work through these pillars and you get it spinning, then it's going to move with this perpetual motion, which brings around investment, infrastructure, and all these kind of key things we're talking about. But I guess we also do have a large pooled number of assets that are also sitting there. So I think we have that already in the game. It's just how do we unlock that and use it more efficiently and effectively? And I probably haven't answered your question around infrastructure and women's sport, but I think it sits behind that.
Yeah, but for you as a player, you had to probably do it tough a lot of the time because you didn't have access to the best coaches, the best resources. How do you see the before and after? Now that we're starting to invest in women's football, can you put an example to that change or how it's allowed young girls to become the semi-curse? Like how does that change come about?
I think it's been a process of just acknowledgement and people being conscious in the decisions that they make. I still think there's a lot of investment that needs to be made, and it's come about just by seeing the potential that sits behind women's football and what that creates. There's a whole new fan pathway. There's, you know, accessibility for young players to become rising stars. And I think it's come about just from a changing in attitudes, but I still don't think we're anywhere close to unlocking what we really can.
John, I want to put a question to you about fees. So that's a really emotive and topical area about the costs of playing. And I think in a perfect world, we'd all love there'd be no cost attached to playing football. But the reality is that everywhere in the world, there's a cost base to the delivery of football, whether it's facilities, coaches, equipment, somebody foots the bill. And in Australia, it's disproportionately the mums and dads. But what I want to do is challenge that view. And I want to get your feedback on this is we have for every one kid. So I see this as being about access rather than about cost. Now, we don't want any kid to miss out. But what I'd say is there's so much additional money that mums and dads are spending on things like private academies and international tours and all this money that's being invested in kids that it sits outside the club structures. Is it really a cost factor, or are we just really inefficient and unstructured in the way we're delivering junior football?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I don't think it's just the cost factor. I think it's a little bit what Peter's saying about the facilities. You know, so, you know, parents that pay between $1,700 and $2,500, you know, they don't expect their kids to go to a club and train in a corner of a pitch, you know, 20 kids.
Yeah.
So they expect better facilities. They expect better coaching, because sometimes the coaching's not that great, or it's not at the level they're expecting. And this is where I think, you know, we don't want to completely criticize some of these private academies, because the coaching might be better than what their clubs are giving them. So I don't think it is totally financial. Yes, there is.
Pay for money. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it's the way we use the money, and it's the way that what they're getting for the value for their money in terms of, you know, this is where it's important that they know where they're sending their kids and what clubs they're sending their kids to. Because if they're going to spend that money, they want to make sure they're getting a certain level of coaching, a level of team environment, a level of club environment. So that's important. Now, you know, there's others that can't afford it. We understand that come from different sorts of backgrounds. That's where, yes, we can help with the registration fees. Yes, they, you know, like schools do, that they can give them scholarships and they can give them, and you know, in the better clubs. Now, I still believe that once we get to a certain level, an elite level, and talking about some elite academies in terms of A-League, I think it should be there shouldn't be a cost for that, because they should be able to select the best players going around in their area. Now, there shouldn't be a cost to that. There should be, you know, that they shouldn't have to pay registration fees. But back to your original question, I think that parents have got the money. They just want to make sure that they're getting value for buck.
Mm. I'm just going to chime in here.
I was just going to throw to you, David.
Oh, thanks, John. half volley. I didn't have too much confidence in you, so I thought I'd jump in. But no, look, in terms of the high costs, we've clearly still got massive numbers, but what the high costs are doing, it means that we are missing out on some players. I mean, we know globally over the last 100 years, some of the best players in the world, and even some of the, you know, best Australian players have come from, you know, pretty from poor backgrounds. So I've got no doubt we're missing out on potential top end players and, you know, potentially world class athletes who are going to other sports. But in terms of, I mean, there's obviously a real disconnect in terms of the youth structures and pathways. And when I go back to the golden generation, when I was playing juniors, I wasn't a very good player at all. But I thought that junior system, and it's something that was massively underrated in terms of that Soccer Australia and the NSL era, there were clearly defined pathways there. You know, you play for your club, then you've got your regionals, and then from the regionals, which covers, you know, basically all the states, your state teams are picked, they go into the national championships, and then from there the national teams are selected, and obviously AIS, etc. Then you also had the school system slotting in, which I'm not sure how well run that was, but I do remember that the Australian or how well structured it was, but I do remember that the Victorian schoolboys and the state schoolboy system, and ultimately the Australian schoolboy system, was quite revered, you know, to the point where that's where Mark Bresciano was spotted. He didn't play a lot of representative football, but was spotted playing for the Australian schoolboys team. And back to, I guess, your point, John, when you look at, you know, the additional fees being paid with academies, and you look at how underutilized schools are at the moment, because schools play a massive role in producing athletes in a lot of other sports, and a lot of these school competitions are quite revered. And you know, the schools, all the kids come down and watch, you know, swimming and athletics and even football, you know, to the point where some players can't play for their TAC Cup teams, for instance, in AFL, they have to play for their school. But I know I've been involved at junior level, and I know there's been a lot of tension at NPL level between NPL and schools, for instance. So again, I mean, it's sort of the common thread, this disconnect. But if we can somehow create a cohesive system and get, you know, the schools and all of these things working in together, I think things could turn around pretty quickly. It's a very difficult challenge, something that can't be done overnight. But, you know, in terms of the overall contact hours and, you know, the whole cultural play, I think things could turn around really quickly when you look at the number of players playing football.
I'm going to put my North Geelong Warriors hat on at the moment. I'm going to, in that context, raise one of my next crazy idea. Is one of the things that we find really hard at North Geelong is government funding. And the reason why is because we own our own facility. And one of the things that Pete spoke about at the outset was the capital that exists within the member feds. Yet we often consider ourselves to be a poor sport. But I'd reckon that of all the sports, and this is just me guessing, I reckon we'd have the highest rate of private facility ownership. I don't know too many AFL clubs or cricket clubs who own their own facilities. Yet, if you look at soccer clubs around Australia, I'd reckon there'd be probably guessing in the hundreds of clubs that would own their own premises. And that's very much, I'll use the political correct term, a very Southern European thing to do, as we always would know. When you know, why rent when you can buy it? So a lot of our forefathers went and bought their facilities. So one of the things that I, you know, in working through North Geelong, we would spend hours and hours and hours, 80% of our time trying to get government funding, and we just hit brick wall after brick wall after brick wall. In the last couple of years, thanks to, I think, to Football Victoria's work too, we've been able to unlock some of that capital, but it's taken us decades. And I don't see why we can't actually, as a sport, unite and bring all that privately owned, all those privately owned real estate assets together under one national trust, and then use it as this huge collateral to draw funding against. You know, the thing about sporting clubs is they're incredibly durable. If you look at your average company, they might last for 10 years. The average sporting club lasts for centuries or century. You know, like every AFL club has been around, Melbourne-based one's been around since the 1800s. you know, all the junior clubs we grew up with have been around for decades and decades, and there's no end in sight. So as collateral, they're really secure assets. And so the ability to get, you know, maybe $500 million or $1 billion worth of assets in one trust, and then use as some sort of a fund to work with government to reinvest in those facilities, I think would be something we should definitely be looking at.
100%.
As a wacky idea, you know, how do we use what is a weakness and turn it into a bit of a strength? But, you know, to that point, Pete, I'd like to get your views. You're the commercial brain amongst us. Like, we certainly need to better, and this comes back to that governance point, we need to better align the way we commercialise the game so that,
that's right,
you know, what's happening with the Socceroos and Matildas is commercialised in, right, in cooperation with the A-League, but then also at grassroots, at clubland. So a sponsor who comes into the game can have this grassroots to glory proposition. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, why that's important?
Oh, it's massive. Look, at the moment, look, sponsorship is very sophisticated. So, you know, sponsorship is one where if we're going to, you know, go to a sponsor and say, we want you to sponsor the Matildas, there's a lot involved with that, you know, because it's marketing dollars that they're taking out of their coffers to put into a sponsorship. So the return on investment and return on objectives is sophisticated, really sophisticated. And, you know, we need to be better at doing that. You know, we're down on ourselves. And, you know, one of the things we've done in Victoria, we've started this Home of the Matildas project. And you know, for the listeners and for some of you who don't know, it's a $90 million project over two phases that we've put forward to government. We've already got $15 million commitment from the federal government. The state government now has got a business case that's been submitted, and it's going to cabinet for budget consideration this year. So our vision is to build the Home of the Matildas and make Victoria the centre of excellence for women's leadership programs, the Matildas, young Matildas development programs. It's a $90 million asset, you know. And for me, that's, we've worked hard to get to where we've had. It's taken years, you know, and we've now got, you know, the federal government, you know, believes in this project through the Minister of Sport. We've worked really hard with the narrative piece and the value proposition we've put forward to the state government. We've got FFA support, you know, to do this. For me, that is vital investment, which we can be able to, build upon a great story of the Matildas by, you know, bringing it here. And my point to the FFA is, well, another state can maybe look at being the home of the Socceroos and try and unlock another $90 million or $100 million to build a centre. That's how we're going to build an asset base and a bit of culture. So, and from there, you know, we can start building that value proposition. I was part of rebranding the Australian swim team back to the Dolphins. And that was a very deep, deep dive brand strategy. And that came about because we got the swimmers in the room.
Pardon the pun.
Sorry?
Pardon the pun.
Yeah. The Dolphins, the Telstra Dolphins, the swimmers told us when they were little girls or little boys swimming in the pool, they wanted to be Telstra Dolphins. And what did Swimming Australia do, you know, in subsequent years? They got rid of that tag Dolphins. And we reignited it. And on the back of that, in terms of building a brand that captured the hearts and minds of the Australian public, that was the whole basis of that. You know, we were able to, you know, come up with an Australian Dolphin swim team with new brand strategy behind that, which the swimmers loved it. You know, when they went to Rio, I'll tell you a funny story about that. When they went to the Olympics in Rio, Kitty Chiller was furious because the Australian swimmers were walking around with their T-shirts, Australian Dolphins, and in the back they had this a big slogan which we had trademarked, the spirit of the green and gold, because for them they were the Australian Dolphins. They weren't the Australian swim. They weren't the Australian Olympic team. They were the Australian Dolphins. You know, and for me, there's value in that, and we were able to sell about $10 million worth of sponsorship on the back of that. Of the whole back, and I don't think we've got, you know, $10 million worth of sponsorship in our women's sport, right? And there's ways to do it, but we need to go back, as I said, to the value proposition, a very deep dive brand strategy, capture the hearts and minds. And I want to see the venues full. When the Matildas and the Socceroos are playing internationals here in our country, I want to see our venues full. I can't say we're seeing our venues full at the moment.
You can call us the PFA Dolphins if you can get us 10 million, Pete. No, I reckon.
Sorry about that.
You know, look, other point I reckon that's a bit untapped to that point around full stadiums is I've been a Geelong AFL member, I reckon, for 10 years.
Yeah.
Past 10 years. And I think I've been to 3 games in 10 years. Yeah. So what my membership is, it's about an emotional stake in that institution as opposed to access to a game. And I reckon a lot of people, like if you look at, you know, one of the examples that we've used in some modelling, like you look at Richmond, for example, they've got 100,000 members, but their average crowd's 60,000. So it tells you that on any given day, 40,000 people that have nominally paid for that game aren't going. So the value is very much anchored to being aligned with the brand and aligned with what the club or the team means to them. And I think that's a real opportunity for the Socceroos and the Matildas. Like, why can't we sell memberships to those two teams? You know, you don't have to necessarily have a game attached to it. But if you provide the you know, the scarves and the tops and the other merch that goes with the membership package and give them something tangible to say, I'm actually invested in the
Kate Gill sticker.
But like that's a way to unlock, you know, like if you sold a membership for $100 and had 100,000 people sign up, you know, it's pretty imposing amount of cash.
And that's achievable. That's achievable, John. That's how you build something special, you know. And on the cost of football point, can I just raise something?
Yeah.
I just think that we've got to be careful with that narrative as well, because I think a lot of people are referring to the NPL fees in our sport. NPL only represents 6% of our participation base. There's another 94% of recreational programs, you know, that deliver, you know, for much, much less money than an NPL program. You know, and with the NPL programs, we've got to turn that conversation around to the value of the NPL programs, not the cost. Because when you work out a 45-week program, you know, the highly, you know, four touch points a week, highly specialized coaching and technical direction and facilities, you know, there is value there. Of course, we want to drive costs down, but I think so often people from other sports are comparing us, our NPL fees, to Auskick, and it's a completely different product.
Hey, stop bringing facts into these debates. Don't you know you're ruined podcasts? Yeah. I mean, come on. I think the final sort of question I'll pose to everybody, like not to everybody, but I'll just ask this finally, is, you know, one of the things about football is there's a lot of things that happen within football that sit outside the football economy.
Yeah.
So things like private academies, sports tourism, private tournaments, beach soccer, futsal. And we don't really have a plan or a strategy on how to bring those really important areas of the game into the tent. Like, how important is our ability to do that? And is that something we should be focusing on, Pete, you reckon? And this to the others too?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we should be focusing on all those. I think at the moment in football, you know, this is why I love these discussions and debates, because for the last 15 years, there hasn't been this discussion and debate. And that's the way we're going to get better. We need to be open to any ideas until we narrow them down to what we can do with effect. You know, and unless we have these discussions and put these ideas forward, we're never going to progress.
Dave? David Davidovich?
Sorry, I was just, talking about academies. Yeah,
There's a lot of money that doesn't sit within the game's formal structures. Like how proactive do you think we need to be to start, you know, bolting on all of these different areas of the sport together? Futsal,
massively. Academies, I mean, tourism, well, considering the FFA last year turned over $132 million, I would say that if you're, you know, looking at all these other areas that you discuss, private academies, etc., I mean, this is a ballpark figure, but you could comfortably double that in terms of money in the game. So that doesn't necessarily mean that all of that money should be, you know, should flow back to the FFA necessarily, but I think it's something that absolutely needs to be reviewed. And ultimately, the FFA, you know, can and should be the, you know, football's custodian here. And look, private academies, for instance, have been quite a, you know, it's a controversial subject. But like most things, like, you know, journalists and real estate agents and, you know, used car salesmen, there's some good ones, but there's a lot of poor ones. And unfortunately, the bad ones tend to, you know, tend to sully it for the better ones. So, you know, there's some academies out there that do an absolutely outstanding job and, you know, play a big role in terms of, you know, producing players, etc. So I think whether it's the FFA or whether a separate, you know, committee, another committee is, set up to review these things, absolutely, because, you know, yes, it is about, you know, the economic reasons, but ultimately, again, weaving back to the original point, sort of, if we can connect all of these, you know, different areas of the game and getting them to, you know, to work in together, we're going to progress a lot quicker.
I'll ask everyone a final question because we need to wrap this up. But what, John, I'll start with you. What do you think is the game's most important next step? If you could narrow it down to one action, what do you think that needs to be?
Restructure the A-League. I think that's the most important step. And we can do it now immediately because we've got time to do it and before it starts up again. And it's the A-League, B-League, you know, because I think we need a second division to actually start to come into play. And then I think the flow-on effect will help, you know, our culture, will help our producing players, and they will help our national teams, whether that's the Socceroos or Matildas. So for me, I think that's the most important thing to get right and do it immediately now and do it properly, because if we don't, and we've seen the issues that we've had with the A-League in terms of players being stood down and coaches and everything else, we've got a massive issue. It's a league that's ready to fall over. Let's try and make it better and make the product better, and let's do it straight away.
Kate, over to you.
I agree with John's commitment to a sustainable professional league and one that has a purpose and a direction.
Yeah. Pete?
Unity of purpose, first and foremost, the national strategy and a complete competition structure overhaul.
David?
Agree with all of you, but I mean, further to John's point, you know, obviously weaving W League into that, because I reckon it's a really critical time for the W League, and we're not really sure where it's going. And I think W League Chiefs have been blindsided a little bit with the exodus of gun players overseas, particularly to England. And governance, because ultimately restructuring the A League and the W League can't happen without the right governance structures. So those two simultaneously are the absolute priorities.
Well, thank you all for.
What about you, John? Your thoughts?
Me, look, I think we've got to get the foundation right, and that's about really getting a sense of shared values across the entire sport. You know, we as a football community need to really redefine who we are, why we're valuable to this country, why we can contribute to this country, and have that real sense of purpose as a group, as a collective. And I think once we define that, I think a lot of our other decisions will be made a lot easier, because we know what we're selling, we know who we want to be. You know, I want us to be proud of being football people again. I want us not to be self-conscious about the life choices we've made to invest in this game that infuriates us and drives us to tears more often than it does to laughter. And that's what I really want to get. I want to share that. I want to build that. And I think that's a really powerful starting point. And then a lot of these other areas around governance and pathways and competition design will almost sort themselves out once we get that right.
So JD, just on this, because this has been a great discussion, which I've really enjoyed, and you know, we've come up with ideas and possible solutions. How can we make it happen? Because, you know, are we relying on just the FFA to make it happen? Are we relying on just the, you know, the A-League clubs or the federations to make it happen? No, how do we?
Yeah, it's good. That's a great point. I've always been a huge believer that everybody needs to take ownership of that. We can't defer to whether it's FFA or State Fed to do those sorts of things. If people are passionate about a specific issue, they should find their voice. From my perspective, then certainly through the PFA, we've always never shied away from doing that. You know, with the research piece we did last year, the town hall we did around women's football with FFA a couple of years ago. But if there is a good idea, I think it's key to drive it, get it out there, pop it, socialize it with people, get people engaged. And if they haven't got time or they're not interested, that's fine. You just go ahead and do it anyway.
Yeah, it's funny that because of this moment, we've actually started to reconnect, ex-teammates. So we had that discussion on Optus, but we've also got a chat group we call the Golden Generation, funny enough. And, we've got whoever was on that show, but we've also got Chipperfield that's on board, Luke Wilshire. We've got Darren Burgess that was the high-performance coach for a number of years of the Socceroos, but also, you know, at Liverpool and Arsenal. Ron Smith, who we regard highly for, you know, being able to bring us through. And we've actually been Lucas Neal, which we haven't heard from for a long time. And so he's passionate about it. And there's a number of Spider Kalats. So there's a number of us that are trying to get together and discuss it, because like you guys with the PFA, we feel that we're trying to make a difference, and we all want the same thing, the game to improve. So hopefully we can do that.
Yeah.
There's only one way we can do that, though, is that we can pass our opinions and find our voice, as John says, without judgment, because our sport too often judges people for coming out and saying what they feel. We should be able to have these discussions free of judgment.
Yeah, for sure. And look, I think that's like one of the first big ideas we had was a big town hall. Get everybody who's passionate about the game, not only from inside the game, but outside the sport. People have got other areas of expertise, but understand how sport works, and coming together and saying, okay, here's what our mission is as a sport. Here's what our mission is. Here's what we want to be as a collective. That's great. Thanks, everyone, for your time.
Just a quick question to finish.
I'll leave the last.
John Aloisi, yes. Which chat did you enjoy more, Optus Sport or this one?
Well, you know what? I was half trying to take over for a little bit, JD, because I was running it last time. I just got into that groove. Sorry if I interrupted a few times. I enjoyed both, Dave.
Thanks.
Yeah, good on you, mate.
Good stuff. Great chatting, boys.
Thanks, Kate.
Thank you.
Thanks, Pete. Thanks, John. And
thanks,
JD. Thanks, Kate. Appreciate the opportunity.
See you guys.
See ya. Thanks.